Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. Today we have two special guests, Charles Todd in the form of Charles Todd and his mother, Carolyn Todd, who are here to talk about, I think it's their 19th book, I'll ask them for sure, An Unmarked Grave. This is the new Bess Crawford mystery. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm just fine. It's always good to talk to you guys. You guys are just really special people.
Oh, thank you.
I always say that. When I say it to an author, I always love to hear their reaction to it. That's great. That's why it's so great to do interviews, because you never know how the author's going to react.
No, that's true.
So,
coming from you, it means a lot.
Yeah. Is this indeed book number 19? Was I right?
I believe it is.
Yeah.
It's the fourth best Crawford.
I decided that for the 20th book, they should give you a nice big raise.
There's 14 Routledges, four Bess Crawfords, and one standalone.
Right.
We just handed in the new Routledge about a month and a half ago.
Oh, wow. Can we reveal the title?
Yes. It's called Proof of Guilt.
Proof of Guilt. Ooh, I like that.
Yeah.
I always like your titles, though.
It's a very good one. It took us a while to decide what the title should be, and then all of a sudden Routledge said something, and we thought, ooh, he's right. Proof of Guilt.
We tend to write the book and then work on the title, and it's always kind of funny. Am I giving away company secrets if I tell them what we do?
Oh, I hope so.
when we're saving it on the computer and working on it, it's always RUT...
whatever the number is.
14, let's say. And then when you start working with the editor, you have RUT 14APC. And then we finally come up with the title and change the name.
Why are titles so difficult?
Sometimes they come very easily. Watchers of Time came before we had actually started writing the book. We had blocked it out, and then I went off to Egypt. And while I was there, I saw this plinth in the in a courtyard in Thebes, in the temple there. And the guide pointed it out as the three apes who are the Watchers of Time. And I thought, oh, that's perfect. So we transported that plinth to a garden in Norfolk and use that as our way of talking about time as a factor in building a crime. That sometimes it isn't spontaneous; it builds up over time.
I can't wait to read the next Routledge. Now I'm all excited about the Routledge. I'm forgetting what I wanted to ask now.
I'm not going to tell you how I happened across A Fierce and Doubt.
Oh, really?
That came out of the
Might
story,
be embarrassing.
Too.
Yes. I'm just being a little
flippant.
Humorous.
But, I mean, you guys, I mean, I'm just amazed. Every time I read one of your books, I think, you know, how do they make these stories? I mean, how do they make it so it's realistic? I mean, the story's got to be perfect, and everything's got to flow nicely. Everything's got to make sense, and the murder's got to make sense. And this is not easy to do. I mean, and you know, when you read them, and I've read all the Routledge ones now, I know that it can't be easy. It can't be just sitting down and it flows out of you.
You want to know a secret?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a collaboration, too. Because we working scene by scene and going over it together until both of us feel like it's complete and we're ready to move on, although sometimes we go back, lends itself to what Caroline's about to say.
I don't think we really know how we do it. I mean, we know how we work. We know how we build the characters. We know how we use the setting and the war, but I really don't know where the knowledge comes from. And I've said this before, I think, that as you're listening to your characters and seeing them in the setting, things happen that you had no idea were there. People will confess to something. Routledge will stumble on a clue, and you think, oh my goodness, oh, that was clever. How did we do it?
We didn't have a manual, obviously. There was nothing to tell us what the rules were to this process. And the only thing I think that makes somewhat of a difference is having diverse life experiences and knowledge of people that the two of us have developed collectively when I was growing up, and then separately when I went on to a career and she went off to Egypt, and you know, so you have the shared experience and then the diverse experience. But as Caroline said, if I had to precisely put my finger on it, I don't think I could.
For example, there in A Matter of Justice, there was something at the murder scene that we couldn't quite put our finger on, and we didn't we didn't know exactly how it was going to play out, so we skipped it temporarily, put an asterisk in, and skipped it until we could get farther into the book and think about why this anomaly was there. And then about two-thirds of the way through the book, maybe a little more like three-quarters, something happened that explained that anomaly completely. And we had no idea that was how it was going to play, to turn out. But it just clicked.
That particular, without going into too much detail, that particular means of death and display goes back to some very interesting parts of British history, to the Danes and that era of English history where England was really split in half, and why we happen to think of using it for this, I can't really tell you, but it seemed appropriate. Rather than just saying, what's a really gory way to have something happen?
You almost make it sound like it's something, like, I know as I go through life, sometimes I feel like God's watching over me. Sometimes he'll show me things that I don't normally see, and I'll think, well, who's telling me that? And then I suddenly get this feeling that God is showing me this stuff. Does that sound weird?
No, not at all.
I mean, that's the way you make it sound. Like there's somebody watching over you and pointing these things out to you.
Yeah, it's really strange because it comes seemingly out of nowhere, and yet when you start to examine what you've thought of, it fits the characters, it fits the crime, it fits the setting. It's a lot of fun. I mean, it's as exciting for us as it is for the reader, because we have no idea when we start out what the book's going to be about, what's going to happen, or anything. We have no outline.
Mm-hmm. We should talk about it on Unmarked Grave. Let's use that as an example. Where did this idea come about? Now, this by the way, is out a little bit earlier than your best Crawfords are usually out.
A lot of people thought that it, in the industry, thought it would be very good to have a book at the beginning of the summer rather than the end of the summer.
Oh, I see. This is going to be an every year thing now?
I don't know. We'll have to look at the returns and see how pleased they are with this. But I suspect it worked out well enough that they will stay with it.
All right. Now, we've never...
just signed a contract for two more books of each character.
Oh, how nice.
Yes, it is very nice.
You know, it's strange. You still get that feeling of dread when you... We have a wonderful relationship with our publisher and our editor, but you always have that tinge when your contract's up for renewal.
Mm-hmm. But going back to...
But the good news is you guys really know what you're doing. And there's no doubt in my mind after reading all these books that you know what you're doing. And every...
I think HarperCollins tomorrow really picks up on that. I mean, they've been so supportive. They've let us do things without telling them more than, well, this one's going to be set in such and such a place.
What is it we say is our best form of fiction, Caroline?
Yes, the proposal.
I mean, I look through the catalogs of the books that are coming out, and I think, wow, all this talent, all this stuff coming out, how do they do it? How do the authors come up with these ideas? And there's always a fresh idea, and it just amazes me. I mean, you read the synopsis, and you think, well, has that ever been told before? And it seems new, even though the story may have been told in a different way.
I was at the beach in Florida, and there was a lady there who was painting T-shirts with an airbrush, and you buy the T-shirt, tell her what you want to put on it, and if you want to customize, and she would sit there and, you know, add the colors and everything, and you'd watch her build that painting on that T-shirt, and she made it look so effortless, and she knew exactly what she was doing, laying down the different colors and building up the different items. And I must have stood there for an hour, I was waiting for some other people who were souvenir shopping, and I just stood there and watched her in just complete amazement, because she made it look so easy.
And we read other authors and feel much the same way. We'll finish a book and think, oh my gosh, that was really clever. That really worked. And it's a pleasure to do that.
I mean, you
want a book that's satisfying. And there are a lot of good authors out there right now.
Well, this and Omar Gray, this is Bess Crawford, is really in danger in this book. I mean, she is really...
It's our first best thriller. And really, that's what it turned out to be. The whole thing started when we wanted to do something with the 1918 flu epidemic. And it was the 20th century plague. It hit people who had no immunity, no idea what was going on. And this is just like the Black Death in the 1300s. It was like the bubonic plague in the 1600s.
Mm-hmm. People don't realize that there were, I believe, right at 11 million casualties in World War I,
wow.
And yet there were 19 million in the influenza epidemic.
Mm-hmm. So we were thinking, we don't want to just have Bess deal with patients. I mean, that's not really a plot.
Yeah.
So what would happen if Bess was dealing with the patients, something happened, and then she fell ill, and like so many people who have had high fevers and very serious illnesses, afterwards she couldn't remember whether what she had seen was real or a part of delirium. And this gave us a chance to set her in motion, so to speak.
And it's kind of typical of Bess's character to want to find out which was which. It shows her determination.
Yeah, and her sense of responsibility.
I remember when I read the first Bess Crawford, and I thought, well, you know, Ian Rutledge is such a hard act to follow. I thought, I wonder if I'm going to like this as much. And I found that I did, and I was resisting. I kept saying, well, no, it's not Ian Rutledge. I'm going to be upset because Ian's not in this book. But I found myself falling in love with Bess Crawford and enjoying her stories, too.
It's very interesting because we were at a signing again in Florida, and a woman there said that she had bought one of the Bess Crawford books, I think, A Bitter Truth, because it said Charles Pott on the cover, and she thought it was Rutledge.
Uh-huh.
And she got home and started reading it, and she hated it. And she said, I couldn't stand the book. I couldn't stand Bess Crawford. I didn't want any part of her, but I got sucked into it.
Oh, wow.
And then by the time I finished, Yes, it wasn't a Rutledge, but boy, it was Bess Crawford. And that was a compliment because an awful lot of very fierce Rutledge fans are out there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Indeed. And
we also have our Hamish fan club.
Really?
A lot of people love Hamish.
They really... It's a love-hate kind of thing. They want Rutledge to get better, but they're not really ready to say goodbye to Hamish.
What if you guys had to pick an actor who would play Hamish, who would it be?
Someone with a really good Scottish accent. I was in North Carolina at
So do you picture Hamish as a person? I mean, do you know what he looks like?
Oh, yeah.
He is a person.
He's tall.
Freaky.
He's tall. He has the typical Scottish sandy hair and blue eyes.
Very sarcastic. Very sarcastic.
Well, he has the Covenanter's point of view sometimes.
Right, but it's fun, though.
But it is. It's. He's a very interesting person. And what I was going to tell you was when I was at this signing, what's his name? David Reed. Farrell Coleman was there.
Oh, okay.
And they asked me if I would read a section of the latest Rutledge at that time.
Oh, that's right. That was in Once a Sail.
Yes, and it was mostly Hamish's scene. And I thought, if I get up and read this as a woman's very American voice, it's not going to come across. And so I turned to Reed, and I said, you do a Scottish accent. Well, you read it.
Oh, wow.
And he did in that gravelly voice.
Oh, man.
And, you know, it gave you cold chills because here was Hamish speaking, and he did the Scots accent perfectly.
One of the really strange things, Caroline, you're going to have to help me with the gentleman's name. We were guests of honor at Magna Cum Murder, which is a wonderful event up in Muncie, Indiana.
Right.
And I want to say his last name was White.
Yes, it was. It was White.
Very well-known director of action scenes.
Oh, okay.
And he worked with some acting students from Ball State University who came at the dinner and reenacted one of the action scenes.
One of the fight scenes.
The fight scenes from Wings of Fire, wasn't it?
No, it was the one set in, I can't even think of the title, A Long Shadow.
Yes, A
okay.
Long Shadow. And
they had Hamish off stage, and then these two young men, about the age of the men in the trenches, who did a real fight scene. And this man, White, had done fight scenes in ballet and TV.
Major motion pictures.
On stage. He was just fantastic. And it came across.
Just recently.
Yeah. I mean, it came across so real. I just sat there with my mouth open because I thought, here it is coming to life. It was really fantastic. And he walked up to me and said afterwards, did I do it justice? And I thought,
oh, man.
How do you tell him? He certainly did it justice.
That's great.
So one of these days, if it ever comes to Masterpiece Theater, we know it's going to be spectacular because those two instances of seeing it, quote unquote, really, really whetted our appetite.
Oh, I can't wait to see it in a Masterpiece. I hope they do it sometime.
That'd well, we've wonderful. Had some feelers. They haven't worked out, but they will. They will.
So you think eventually we are going to see it on TV?
Yes. And I have no idea who will play the role. Someone suggested that David Tennant would be very good as Rutledge. You know, he'd been one of the Doctor Who's.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a very interesting actor.
I've always said that if they do as well with taking Jeremy Brett and David Suchet for their roles, because I would not have picked either one of those actors.
Yeah.
For J. Stephen White was the name of the gentleman I was thinking of, and but they
David Suchet was just perfect.
Yeah,
oh,
just walked right out of the page, and so I always read that sticks out in my mind when people ask the question.
Hmm. Well, Unmarked Grave, I mean, reading this book, and there's a man pursuing Beth, too, which is really interesting to read. I mean, he really has a, I think he has a crush on her.
Well, you haven't finished it yet.
No, I haven't.
So I won't be a spoiler, but...
Every time I say stuff like that, something that always is a response I get. Well, where do you finish it?
But Beth is part of something she doesn't understand.
Ah.
And it's slowly but surely that she takes the different pieces of the puzzle, puts them together, and sees who is in danger and why. And that was very exciting to work with.
Hmm. Well, I can't wait to finish it tonight. I may be up all night reading it now.
Well, most of our readers are. We just had another email from someone who said, I was up until 2 a.m., but I was determined to finish it.
Now, what is the term you use for somebody who deserts the war? There's a term in here I'd never heard before. What's the word you use?
Which one?
Oh, I'm forgetting the word there. There's a particular word you use for war deserters that I had never heard before.
Oh. And I can't think offhand what it was, but...
I'll have to look, and if you don't remember the... I'm trying to remember the... When I saw it, I thought, I didn't know that's what that word meant.
One of those things, your mind just goes blank.
Well, the problem is...
I should have underlined it, or...
We are currently doing the copy edits for Routledge.
Right.
And at the same time, getting started on the next Beth. So, you know, our brains are a little bit warped right now.
Right. It must be a lot much harder to do two books a year.
It has been. We thought it would be easy because we were both set in or after the war. But it has also been fascinating. I mean, to watch Beth and then turn around and do a Routledge, he's a professional. She's an amateur, but she doesn't go looking for crimes to solve. In each case, they have more or less come to her. And on that basis, she's just been really intriguing to work with.
Right. And I find it fascinating that she has people watching her back. She knows a lot of people, too. And her father always seems to have his hand in something that's going on in her life. Like, he's behind the scenes making sure she's okay.
Yes, he keeps an eye on her. He's, like many fathers of that era, he let her have her head when it came to joining the Queen Alexandra Nursing Corps, but he also makes sure that she stays safe.
Right.
He's run he's ruled a regiment, and he says at one point in the book that was easier than raising a daughter.
Now, is one series harder than the other series to do, or are they equally... It's tough to write.
Routledge may be a little harder.
Why is that?
The plots are a little darker.
More psychological, too, I think.
Yeah, there's psychology and the psychological suspense in Beth, but in Routledge, because of the way we set him up at the beginning, there have been a great number of plots that, I mean, you take A Matter of Justice. That was a very dark plot. And yet, all the pieces fell into place.
Mm-hmm.
John used to say when he was proofreading, he proofreads.
Mm-hmm.
And being a good engineer, he catches all the things before we send them in to the editor. And he keeps saying about a third of the way through a book, oh, I don't think you're going to get this one to come together.
Right.
And then about two-thirds of the way, oh, I don't know. And then finally he comes to the end and he says, I don't know how you did it, but all the pieces fit together.
that's
we don't know either.
That's the beauty of it. I mean, that's what makes you guys such masters at this, because you do know how to do that. Somehow you always manage to do it with each book. I mean, I've never finished one of these books and said, well, that doesn't make any sense. I don't think that ending was appropriate.
You wind up holding your breath a lot.
Do you? But isn't it fun? Isn't it fun to write?
Yes, yes.
Is it ever not fun?
When you're 2 days over a deadline, it gets a little hairy.
Yeah.
That's the one thing that was so dramatic for us, because when we wrote Test of Wills, there was no rush. You know, we were enjoying the process rather than the heading for the completion. And we still get to do that, but when you're putting out 2 books a year plus several short stories and anthology things, quality is something that really becomes something that we watch very carefully.
Now, how long did the influenza last?
It hit very hard, came back, and hit again. It lasted maybe 18 months all told, or thereabouts, because it was a worldwide conflagration, and you couldn't, you know, when it was beginning to wane in one country, it was just beginning in another.
You have to understand, World War One brought a lot of people from a lot of different places into the different fronts in the war. You had African troops in the trenches in Europe, primarily North African, but you had the different African natives. You had Australians, New Zealanders,
Nepalese, Indian.
Yeah.
And there were Chinese there as well.
All kinds.
So,
when they went home, they brought a little extra package with them.
It was really a terrible thing, and the problem was the very old and the very young seemed to be less susceptible to the virulent form, and it was the young people who suffered most. They said there were people who took ill at noon and who were dead by midnight.
Now, would it wipe out whole families?
Yes.
I mean, it was that contagious?
Yes.
Yes, it was. And there was a time in the United States with a variety of different illnesses. I think scarlet fever was one of them, where you actually put a quarantine sign on your house. It was required.
Measles?
Yeah, so that people would know that that house was under quarantine and you didn't go in there.
What a scary time to live in.
That
was prevalent all over the United States in the 20s, 30s, and even 40s.
For example, lost my train of thought. My grandmother had a baby during the worst of the flu epidemic, and because there weren't enough doctors and nurses to take care of the baby and her, the baby didn't make it.
Oh.
And this is, you know, this is the kind of thing that leaves a scar. I mean,
it reinforced a lot of fears about hospitals, because for a very long time, instead of, you know, you had the doctor come to your house if you were extremely ill, but you tried to avoid going into hospitals because they were known for their, as being a place where you would go and become infected with other things. You kind of think about, for example, Staff and Mercer in hospitals nowadays, and think back to the 20s, they didn't really like or trust hospitals to begin with, and it kind of set that back considerably until the advent of antibiotics.
Right. Yeah. But even now today, they're talking about hospitals, how dangerous they are.
Oh, yeah.
That's why I mentioned the I'm not trying to say hospitals are dangerous places,
oh, I know. Yeah.
But you could understand why people had those concerns as a result of the influenza epidemic.
And too, today, you know, one of the things we like about the period that we're using is that it has a way of reaching into the present, politically, historically, economically. So many things are very similar to what they were like in World War One. So it's not just quote unquote an historical novel. It's something that is very readable in its own period, but also touches on a lot of things that we know about today, just like the illness or like the problems in the Middle East or whatever.
And what was surprising me in this book is that Beth's mother is keeping secrets from her. And I thought her mother at first was a very gentle, kind woman, but I'm thinking, boy, this woman's a secret keeper, too. So.
Well, she has to.
Yeah.
What happens, what she is keeping the secret about, in two instances, were things that she knew would upset Beth.
So she's looking out for Beth's well-being. She doesn't want
yes,
her to be upset
and
by anything.
You know, your own mother would do things like that to protect you, and Beth's mother is no different. There's something she doesn't tell Beth at the very beginning because she knew it would upset her while she was convalescing.
Right, and at the same time, Beth is keeping secrets from her father, too. So
yeah.
It really has to.
Sometimes you have to.
Yeah. I remember when I was younger, Mom would always say, don't tell your father because he'll blow up. You know? But there was this terrible fear that if you told him something if he came home and you said, well, we wrecked the car or something, he'd fly into a rage, you know? So you had to keep things from your father, things you
and
could
also,
keep.
Beth is doing rather dangerous work at the front.
Mm-hmm.
And she has to be careful if her parents worry about her too much. Her father could certainly pull strings to have her brought back to England, as he did in the book at one point, brought back to England and kept there.
She has a lot of choices to make in this book.
Yes.
Lots and lots of choices. This is like the book of making choices for Beth.
And people have to address choices so many times when there are emergencies or things are going wrong. You have to make decisions and deal with it the best you can with what information you have.
Now, this book takes place in France and England and anywhere else? I can't remember. Was another location?
Yeah, basically, it was France and England.
Right. Now, how do you say that city in France? R-O-U-E-N?
Rouen.
Rouen. Is that how you say it?
Rouen.
That's him?
Rouen.
So I've been mispronouncing it every time I've read it in the book.
it's an O-N-Rouen.
Huh. Interesting.
And Ypres, which is the British called it weepers or wipers instead of Ypres.
It's interesting to listen to you two. You almost complete your sentences sometimes. You know each other so well.
Well, this is how we work together,
I guess. It's amazing. I don't know how I know her.
You do. You know what she's
somewhere.
Yeah. You know what she's going to say, too. It's almost like radar and MASH. You know, he always knew what the commanding officer was going to say before he said it.
Well, trust me, her radar's far better than mine.
Is it?
Well, we do this with the book. I'll start saying, you know, it'd be very interesting if this woman was Irish, and Charles will say, and had to flee Ireland because of the troubles there. You know, we just sort of build on each other's thoughts.
I mean, the thing is, it is so easy to write a mediocre book. I mean, I've read books that are just totally mediocre. There's nothing remarkable about them. But you never do that. You always write something interesting. You always write an interesting mystery.
Touch wood.
But you do. I mean,
I have been a judge for the Edgar Awards in several different categories. Overall judge, and one competition we started the first year was with St. Martin's, where we accepted unpublished manuscripts and then narrowed it down to five, and then the five went on to St. Martin's, who chose the one that got a
contract.
Writing contract. And I had stacks of them. You know, I was completely surrounded in piles of manuscripts, and some of them were just, you know, I won't comment on. And
right.
Then every once in a while you find one where somebody had come up with a really neat concept, and if they had, you wanted to write them back and say, look, keep working on this when there's something here, you know.
Right. That's it. That's fascinating to be able to do that. I mean, we've all read books where we finish the book and we say, what a tremendous book.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I felt that way about this book called Gone Girl that's out now.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I've heard about it. I haven't read it.
It is just the most spectacular book. I mean, there's something about this way this woman writes that is, I've just fallen in love with this woman's writing.
Yeah, I have a copy of that here.
Make sure you don't miss it.
To touch it yet.
No, make sure you don't miss it because it's worth reading.
Ah, that's wonderful.
It is definitely
worth
reading.
Look forward to.
You just moved up the must-read spec.
There you go. It really is spectacular. I don't say that very easily. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, that's good to know.
But I mean, when you read an author that you just love the way they write, I mean, we all have writers that we just can't get enough of. Do you guys have writers you can't get enough of?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. There are some that you just are so eager. And you have to be careful because sometimes it's okay. You know, and they've written things that are just so spectacular. Just my personal opinion, Alistair MacLean's The Road to Dusty Death,
right,
just kind of left me going, hee-hee, you know, and yet Where Eagles Dare was just fantastic.
Right. How do they do it? How do they do it?
I don't know.
We know another writing team, several of them, in fact, but this one in particular, two men named... who use the name Michael and Stanley. They're two first names together. And they write a series of mysteries set in Botswana with a black policeman. And I've read, what is it, three or four of them now? Three of them, I think. And I just love their books.
Usually what we find, and I always need Caroline's help with this one, she's from Iceland.
Oh, Yrsa Sigurdar's daughter.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
She, you know, you meet these people, and they are absolutely fascinating as just people in general, and you can get this sense. But those two, we always look forward to conventions and things where we know they're going to be there. It's kind of like old home week, because we not only like their books, but we like them as people.
And Lee Child is usually there, and so many of the writers, Val McDermott.
Michael Connelly.
He hasn't been coming as much, but he's been busy.
Right, he's a busy guy.
Yeah, so it's a pleasure for us to meet our own heroes in the writing field. I had a chance to meet Tony Hillerman.
Oh, wow.
To meet, what's his name, who wrote the Morse series.
Oh, yeah.
And this...
Colin Dexter, yeah.
Yes, Colin.
Yeah.
He's a character. And
you know what made a big difference? We know all these people, but what was so nice was when Tessa Wills first came out, there was a group of people, I'm thinking of Jerry Healy and Parnell Hall and quite a few other people that just were so welcoming into
the Myers
industry. Annette and Marty Myers, people that could have just completely ignored us, but brought us in, and S.J. Rosen was one of them. You know, and we were nobody in awe of these people, and one of the things we tried to do is, like Ilsa, when we first met her, to try and do the same thing for other people, because that's what helps the community grow.
Absolutely.
Have you read The Woodcutter by Reginald Hill? I think it was his last
book. You know, I started that book. I couldn't get into it.
Oh, my God. Once you get into it, you see what he's doing, and it's the most stunning revelation.
Really? Oh, great. Now I'm going to have to go back and read it again.
Yeah. When I first started it, I thought, this is not a subject that appeals to me.
Right.
This is not something that I really want to spend my time reading. But my editor had said it was very good. And so I plowed on, and then all of a sudden, when the truth came out, I thought, ye gods, you know, that was so clever.
I still have that on the top of my reading pile. I know exactly where it is. I now want to go back and read it.
Yeah,
definitely.
It isn't it all what you think when you open it and start the story?
Now, Bess, I mean, is it possible for Bess to fall in love? I mean, I know we've discussed about Ian Rutledge not being able to really have a love.
I don't know about Bess. I mean, there have been some very interesting men, the Australian, and A Bitter Truth was someone we really liked. And everybody seems to adore Simon.
Yeah, now will Simon be back?
Oh, Simon's always going to be there, I think. He's been a very interesting character to work with. He was just going to be a background figure, and then suddenly he was more.
It's interesting, because I didn't... you ask these questions, you have to be careful asking these questions, because if something happens to them in the book, you know,
Yes. You've
opened up a can of worms and not even known it.
Yes, you can't say, oh, well, that was the book in which we killed him off.
It's like being a lawyer, you better know the answer before you ask the question.
Absolutely.
Like, you never know what's going to come out, you know?
Yeah.
But
the thing is, as long as Bess is single, she has more range.
And she's a free spirit.
Yes, she is a free spirit. Once she marries and settles down, she will have other priorities. But I think for a while she'll have some interesting people in her life. But she will not necessarily fall in love with
I don't know. I don't know if you ever read the Ann Perry ones with Hester. I can't remember her character name.
Yes.
Where she falls in love with this guy, but they hate each other at first. They can't stand each other.
Yeah.
And it gradually turns into love. And it's remarkable the way she does that in those books, because
Was it Monk that she fell in love with?
Yes.
Yeah.
Monk.
Yes.
She falls in love with Monk, but they're always at odds. They always disagree on almost everything at first.
And even though I was not a big fan of Monk, I loved that relationship.
Yeah. It's truly a wonderful thing to watch, because it gradually turns into love, and I don't want to give too much away if people haven't read it. But
she was a nurse in the Crimean War.
You mean Ann Perry?
No, Hester.
Oh, Hester. Couldn't be Ann Perry. Hester was. Yes. That's right. You're correct.
So that gave her an independence also.
Yeah, absolutely. But do you guys know what's going to happen to Bess 3-4 books from now?
Not really. What we usually have an idea of is something that might come up. Charles and I have been talking about one of the characters in the very first Bess, A Duty to the Dead, was rescued from the sea by Bess when the Britannic sank.
Right.
And we thought, wouldn't it be interesting for Bess to, after the war, go to Ireland for her wedding and find herself pitched into something that she never expected to have to deal with?
Oh, yeah, that sounds wonderful.
And we also like, I think, to take her to India, where her roots are.
So this is really going to happen?
I don't know.
It's in the planning stages.
No, we keep it in the back of our mind.
Okay.
Sort of a what if, and wouldn't it be fun?
Here, I thought we were getting a preview of the next couple besses, right?
We got to finish the war first.
Exactly.
Quite a bit to do with the war.
But that sounds like a great idea, though.
Yeah, we, you know, she can't be fighting forever, and 2014 is coming up.
Right.
100 years, and we want to do something special for that book.
Oh, that's
which
cool.
Will be interesting because that will be the next Rutledge after this one and the next best after the one we're writing right now.
Right, so you're right in the middle of writing another best right now?
We started it, but we're doing the copy edits with proof of guilt first, and we
have
to get that out of the way. They're waiting for that for production.
That's what's so odd, because you're talking to people about an unmarked grave. You've already completed the next Rutledge and are working on the copy edits and trying to think about the next best, and yet still remember enough about an unmarked grave to be able to talk to people.
Exactly. You must think to yourself, oh no, David's going to call. We have to remember everything with unmarked grave now.
You asked us about the word for
deserter.
A deserter.
I know, and now I still can't remember the term. And when I read it, I thought, I've never heard that term before.
Yes.
And I thought, well,
we find these fascinating little tidbits in our research, and they pop up in unexpected places.
Right, and I should have written it down is what I should have done. I don't always do that. I'm so enjoying the book sometimes, I don't like to take the time and...
No, I don't like to interrupt the flow.
Right, that's what I'm saying. When I start writing things in a book or writing character names, I kind of lose my train of thought. And that, you know, that's what I've been finding a lot lately. When I read a book and I put it down too much, I forget where I was, and I completely lose that train. That's why it's so good to read a book all the way through sometimes.
Yes.
Because you get the whole picture, and then you see it. But that's not easy to do, especially with a 400 or 500 page book, you know.
What I do sometimes is circle the number on a page that I want to come back to.
Oh, there you go. That's an idea.
That way I can thumb through the book and, oh, here's one of them. Was this the one I'm looking for?
Well, now you're going to have me looking through this whole book now, finding that word for deserter. I'm going to email you and let you know what it was.
Send us an email.
And I think to myself, well, should I ask him about it? They're going to think, oh, David, he's so stupid. He should know that word by now.
I remember very well somebody saying to me one time, you know you're getting old when you spend most of your time trying to remember somebody's name or looking for a restroom.
Exactly.
But for example, the British refer to regular soldiers under the rank of sergeant as other ranks. It's just a British way of doing it. And then they have a special word for sailors. We use sailors and seamen, but they have the word rating, R-A-T-I-N-G.
Hmm.
And that means, an ordinary seaman.
How about that rating? I always thought that had something to do with TV.
Absolutely, they stole that from the Navy.
This is one of the most fascinating things.
It's very interesting because you don't have ranks. You know, people think of your rank as being lieutenant, captain, sergeant. They have in the enlisted ranks that it's ratings and not ranks. That it's based on your knowledge and skill level, which goes back to the original sailing days as you started out of learning the ropes. You've heard that term.
Oh, yeah.
That means that you're amateur greenhorn, that you've learned the basic knots, but you're not anywhere near being a bosun or a bosun's mate who knows all the knots.
Right.
Well, which rope pulls which part of the sail?
That's another thing, and it just reminded me in the Bess Crawford ones. She's always got to be careful what she's doing. She can't, you know, she can't have in a hotel room with another man. She can't.
Yes, she has certain.
It's not like today where you can just do anything you want and not have to worry about what people think. She had to worry. She had to think about, you know, how was this going to look if they catch me in a hotel with another man?
And it would have reflected on her nursing career, and it would have reflected on her position as a lady with a little L. She's not an Earl's daughter with a capital.
And people didn't forgive very easily back then. I mean, once you were labeled something, you were...
Once you got marked with a moniker, you were set. But it's, in a way, it's less what Bess was afraid people would think, but more of what Bess would think about herself and what she had done to the person that she had through her lifetime endeavored to become. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting.
In those days...
It wasn't a what would happen if I got caught as much as what would this do to me and who I have worked so hard to become.
And what would it makes you think about how would Beth survive in a world like today where every little thing you do can be caught on camera in 5 seconds?
Yeah. Yeah, it's really one reason why we like to write novels set in the past.
I think my mother actually made this quote one time about, you really know the person who you are when you're alone in the dark.
Huh.
And there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah.
When you can't get away from yourself.
You know, there's nobody there. It's completely dark. No video cameras, no nothing. That's who you really are, and that's what determines your real values, worth, and self-image.
Well, do you guys feel like, I mean, you're obviously very talented. I mean, the talent is amazing. To read these books is to know. And I still can remember the enjoyable nights I had reading the Rutledge books, and that'll never leave me. And when I think about that, it's very touching to talk to you guys and to realize that I have shared those moments and the thrill of reading them for the first, you know, for anybody who hasn't read them and can go back and read all the Rutledge ones and to experience those emotions at the end of the book and say, wow, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah, and a lot of people respond that way. It's been very interesting to us that the book captures something for them. And it's very interesting to hear you say the same thing.
I mean, it would be very easy to have every book be very repetitive. Everything, like Murder, She Wrote, where there was a murder in the beginning, an investigation, and then you figure out who, and they told you who did it.
Don't invite Angela Lansbury to dinner.
Right, exactly, because somebody's going to die.
But if you let your characters be characters, if you don't try to turn them into puppets. They turn out to be such individuals. We may borrow a characteristic from this person or that person that we've seen, but we never use real people because you can't make real people do the things that a character has to do. And so you have to listen to that character and say, what is that person trying to say? What is really driving them? Why would this person possibly have contemplated murdering X or Y, whoever the.
So your theory is that people can figure them all out if they just give it a real, if they really think about them, they should be able to figure.
You can let them, you know, go forth and do their thing, and quite often they surprise you. I mean, they Rutledge brought us Hamish. We didn't think up Hamish. Rutledge really brought him to us, and so many of the characters have done the same thing. You suddenly see them in a different light, and you think, "Oh my gosh, it's amazing."
Yeah, I remember, and that's the thing with mysteries, though. Too, I also think to myself, "Do I want to figure it out before the end? Am I going to feel disappointed if I do figure it out before the end?" And a lot of times, the answer is yes. I don't want to figure it out until the ending.
And yet you want to know that the author is playing fair.
Right.
That if at the end it's the doctor who did it or the butler who did it or whatever, that the clues have been there all along. They may have been buried.
Right.
But they were there well enough to justify how the book closes.
Right. Absolutely. I remember... going back to Ann Perry again, there was one Ann Perry I did figure out before the ending, and that's very rare. For some reason, I never figured them out before the ending, but I remember thinking, I know the answer to this book. I know the whole thing. I don't know why. I always remember that it had something to do with a violin, but that's all I remember about the book. But.
Well, it's always a challenge to make sure that the reader stays with you but doesn't know any more than you do until the ending. It's a challenge, but
one of the things,
another it happens.
Yeah, and one other thing too, when an author will have a main character fall in love with somebody and you feel the love that they have, and then all of a sudden at the end it turns out the person they're in love with is a murderer.
Martha Grimes did that a lot,
and that always bothers me. Especially when I fall in love with the character, and then all of a sudden I don't feel the same way about them at the end of the book. All of a sudden I don't like them anymore.
Yeah, that's something you have to consider when you're writing, how people will perceive this person by page 410.
Yeah, like Patricia Cornwell killing off Benton Wesley. I mean, all of a sudden he was gone.
Oh, yes.
And it left a huge, huge hole in the series. I mean, and, you know... That's, you know, you want to do that. Karen Slaughter did the same thing.
Yeah, and I try not to think in those terms, because
you guys don't do that normally.
No, Maggie in A Cold Treachery was someone who was very dear to me. There was something about Maggie that caught my imagination, and even after the book was finished. It was Maggie I remembered in that book, and I could see her standing in the snow with the axe in her hand.
Wow.
And she was just so real. And I wouldn't have wanted to see her go down. I mean, it wouldn't have been within her nature.
Well, you also have to stay real to the story. I mean, it has to be real. I mean, so if somebody is the killer and everything's been pointing that way, it has to end that way.
Yes.
So you can't suddenly say, well, I like the character, I'm not going to make them a killer.
No, because that happened in Search the Dark. The killer was someone we really, really were drawn to. We understood the motive for that murder, and yet that person had to be the murderer. It couldn't have been any other way. And you felt bereft.
Well, I definitely want to see more of Simon. I definitely want to see more of that Englishman. Now, I don't know how this story ends up. I'll be finishing it tonight, so I can't even ask you whether he'll be back for another book, because that would be very wrong of me to ask.
Well, since we haven't started the book, we don't know ourselves.
We don't know ourselves either.
We can't give you an answer, but I would like to think that Simon would be back.
And one other thing, does anybody call themselves Bess anymore? Is Bess used very often anymore?
You know, I tend to run into it, one in the South and the other in some parts of New England where they still use names like Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that Bess qualifies for this, but more biblical names.
And
right.
Bess to me spoke of Queen Elizabeth the Great. She was Bess, young Bess, that sort of thing. And it's sort of, I would like to have thought that Bess as a person was that caliber.
Well, it's amazing how, I mean, Bess and Beth, I mean, everybody uses, Beth is very well used today, but you won't hear very many Beths like to be called Beth.
Well, which is good, because if you use Mary or some of the names that are very common, if you know somebody by that name, it's hard to think of them as the heroine or as the villain.
Right, exactly. Well, it's been this has been a wonderful hour. I mean, we.
Oh, I've enjoyed it, and so has Charles. I'm sure.
It never feels like an hour with you guys because I really enjoy talking to you. It's like I'm talking to old friends.
Yes, it is, and we get into some very interesting aspects of writing. That's what I always enjoy.
And what's even more interesting about you two is you're very unusual people, and I really like that. I like that you're not your.
I'm trying to remember. Was it truancy, Caroline?
No, it wasn't truancy. I'll think of it as soon as I hang up.
There was forsaking, relinquishment, and truancy just came to my mind.
You
know that they're not right.
You're talking about the word for deserting, the war deserter?
Yeah.
No, it wasn't truancy. It's a word that I thought, wait a minute, that doesn't mean that. It means something else.
Yeah, the thing was, they didn't really have AWOL in 1916, 1917, 1918. That's a more an American term. Just like we have MPs, and they had a very different version of the military police in the British Army.
It was more a sense of abandonment and defection than desertion so much.
I'm reminded of that scene in All in the Family where Archie finds out that the kid that's come to dinner was a war deserter.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That scene is so powerful to watch. I mean,
Yes, it was. It put the whole thing into perspective.
It's amazing now to go back and rewatch that show and a couple of others with the perspective of hindsight.
Right.
And they're still, you see new value in the episodes.
And they're just,
you didn't see when they first ran.
And that's the amazing thing about TV. Some shows, after a while, become stale, but you go back and watch All in the Family, it's still just as powerful as it was when it came out.
Yes.
MASH can do that for me, too.
And Hill Street Blues.
Yes, Hill Street Blues, another one.
Really?
The
really,
Wire is another one.
Never syndicated Hill Street Blues.
Yeah, I wonder why.
I have no idea, but that a lot of really well-known actors got their start. James Siking.
James, yeah, exactly.
Take him.
Mm-hmm. His first appearance, he was a patrol officer in the police department in a couple of Columbo episodes when they first discovered the body.
But I had no idea you were such a TV watcher, Charles.
Well, I'm a Columbo fan.
Oh, yeah, my mom was a big Columbo fan, too. In fact, she knew all the episodes.
And so that when I started watching Hill Street Blues, and then, unfortunately, I got into Law and Order, and so I became corrupt.
Right. A lot of people like Law and Order. I wouldn't put you in bad company. That's
well, but I still like Mike. You look at people like Michael Moriarty, who went on to do Pale Rider with Clint Eastwood, which I think was one of the best Clint Eastwood movies ever.
Oh yeah, Pale Rider. Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
You know, so it's interesting to me to see where these actors came from and their experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, we just lost Ernest Borgnine. That was a shame.
Yeah, I hated to see that.
I remember seeing Marty for the first time. And
yeah, that's one of the things. You see these movies on TV that you hadn't... I mean, they were showing it on TV this morning, and right away I thought, I want to watch this movie again.
Because
it's so powerful even then. I mean, you always think of the... I have a friend who refuses to watch any black and white movie. I don't know why. But there's a lot of great black and white films.
Well,
yeah.
You saw, what was the one that got all the Oscar buzz?
Recently.
Yeah, The Artist.
The Artist.
Yes.
I thought that was a neat movie. I really did.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about watching character development is something that is interesting to me in terms of the book, where I watch the different roles that people are able to play. I'm always amazed by actors. You have two types, in my opinion. You have it's always even though they're great, Clint Eastwood's always Clint Eastwood in every movie.
Right, absolutely.
But if you watch things like Robert De Niro, he's very different in a lot of different movies.
Right.
Michael Moriarty was another perfect example. James Siking, you know, those are the actors that just amaze me, and I think Meryl Streep is
at
the top of the class.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, just wonderful.
Sometimes when we're writing, I see the scene play out like a movie.
Do you really?
Yeah, I can see it, and it's just going along, and my fingers are moving as fast as they can across the keyboard before I lose it.
Huh.
It's amazing when your brain gets ahead of your fingers.
Right.
You look back up at the screen and it starts surfing.
Well, I hate to say this, but it's time we have to say goodbye, unfortunately.
Oh, dear. Well, we've enjoyed it so much, David.
We really have to. And I'm Mark Grave is the new Bess Crawford, is number four. And there's all those Rutledge books. I almost forgot his name. Ian Rutledge books. You can go back and make sure you read them all because they're all so wonderful and they're not to be missed. And once again, this has been Charles Todd and his mother Carolyn talking about their new book. And it's available from William Morris and all your bookstores. And this has been David's Book Talk. We'll talk to you next time.